Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray, sponsored by Cybertrust.
Hello and welcome to the Sweet 16th edition of Risky Business for Tuesday, June 5, 2007. I'm Patrick Gray. If this is your first time tuning in, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast through iTunes or another podcatcher. Use the links to the left of the blog posts to subscribe. We've got another great show for you this week. We're a bit light on news, but hey, not much happened this week. Don't worry though, we've got plenty of analysis and some great interviews, so stay tuned. We'll check in with Ausert, as always, to find out what their super geeks are up to. Carl Hanmore will fill us in on the latest AV bugs, and he also has a good news yarn for us. Steve Manzik, Juniper Network's Head of Security Research, will be along to talk about the limitations of IPS and also discuss Apple vulnerabilities. And Paul Nevin, a Security Operations Centre Manager for our sponsor Cybertrust, will be along to talk about the massive denial of service attack that crippled Estonia. But of course, it's time for the news headlines with ZDNet Australia's Munir Kataria. Munir, it looks like there's a bit of cloak and dagger action happening over in the United States.
Oh, this is the fun stuff, isn't it? Yeah, it's HP and Dell, basically. Dell is worried that HP may have robbed some of its trade secrets.
Okay, and what are they doing about that? Are they employing some ex-CIA spy hunters to track them down?
That would be the usual way, wouldn't it?
Yeah, now this is interesting, isn't it? Because it shows that, you know, you can put in all the security controls and whatever you want in place, but at the end of the day, if there's a willful disclosure, there's not much you can do about it.
Oh, totally, that's right. I'm wondering, what exactly is it that Dell would have that HP would want?
Yeah, I think people tend to overestimate the value of their brilliant strategy documents and things like that, don't they?
Can you imagine they've probably got a few PowerPoints and stuff and Dell marketing people are real worried about this?
Yeah, we're going to make computers that are really good and sell lots of them. It's a big trade secret.
Maybe that's something to do with the Linux side of stuff. I don't know. But no, there is some issues there. And HP, I mean, you know, they got into a lot of trouble because they admitted spying on journalists and all sorts of partners and God knows who else.
Yeah, well, I'm acquainted with Stephen Shankland, who is one of the guys in the States who's actually, I believe he's actually suing them now. But yeah, he thought it was quite, he would have liked to think it was quite amusing that HP was going through his rubbish, but I think he regarded it as a bit of an invasion of privacy.
Yeah, totally.
Funny that.
Well, the way it's ended on Friday, basically, HP didn't say whether the company had launched an investigation or not into the Dell allegations. So,
yeah, it's looking, HP's looking very spy versus spy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Now, in terms of unwillful disclosure, we've had a couple of bug reports. We've had some bugs in Mozilla, and also Apple has patched that QuickTime flaw that was exploited at CanSec West.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, these, you know, Apple launched, they fixed a whole load of bugs earlier on, late last month. And this is just another fix-up on QuickTime again. This is, how many QuickTimes has it been this year?
Oh, QuickTimes. Ooh, it got that that backwards compatibility thing that has caused Microsoft so many headaches. You know, it has to be backwardly compatible with all versions. So I think there's a lot of legacy code in there that's probably a little bit frightening.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't think the... The days of QuickTime bugs are over, so we'll just have to keep an eye on that. And Mozilla, again, just a few run-of-the-mill sort of vulnerabilities in a browser, nothing really remarkable.
No, it doesn't seem to be too exciting there.
Symantec has delayed releasing its mobile security suite.
Yeah, that's right, for their Windows Mobile technology. It's interesting. I haven't heard too much about too many exploits or attacks on the Windows Mobile platform. It seems most of them have been on Symbian.
Mm.
But, it seems like they're holding back to make sure that they don't launch it with bugs, which is an interesting way for Symantec to go.
Well, I think everything's been a tad theoretical, when it comes to mobile, the exploitation of mobile devices. Mm. But everyone seems to be tipping it as the next big thing. We had George Daffakopoulos from Microsoft on the show a couple of weeks ago from Ausert.
Yep.
You may have even been in the media room when we did the interview, but he's suggested that... you know, mobile is definitely the next big thing, and it's sort of where IE was, you know, in 1998. So it's sort of an untested, unproven ground, and it could get a little bit, I suppose a surfer would say, gnarly.
Well, one of the problems here is, you know, if the platform isn't getting attacked and you've got all the security stuff down, I mean, it's good that we're, you know, that they seem prepared and there's a lot of security stuff out there for mobile. But I'd like to compare it to, you know, if we look at the Mac, where there's obviously vulnerabilities there. Apple's been patching them like mad all this year, but are people exploiting them? And if they're not, then is the security software going to actually work when somebody does try it?
Yeah. I guess we'll just have to wait and see.
Yep.
Now, Munir, I guess one final news item that's worth mentioning is this Westpac outage, because apparently it wasn't a denial-of-service attack. It's nothing that we can get too excited about. Why don't you fill us in on what the details are saying at this stage?
Oh, I think it's really funny. Westpac has come out officially and said, yeah, the problem is that somebody flicked the wrong switch, and the switch, I can't say this seriously, basically they flicked the wrong switch, and that turned off all the internet banking and all the ATMs.
So someone tripped over the wrong cable in the data center.
I think what they need is the good old remedy where you get a bit of sellotape and a piece of paper and you stick it on the switch and say, do not touch this.
Do not turn off. Okay, well, it's nice to know that they're not being DDoSed by Russian attackers, I guess.
No.
But it makes you wonder about their general competency. Was that actually a statement from the bank, was it?
The bank has told everyone, yes, it's all over the newswires this morning, that somebody flicked the wrong switch. Human error, Westpac said.
Human error. It's at the root of some great catastrophes, like pretty much every plane crash. But this is. I mean, how long have they been down?
They went down on Friday afternoon. I don't know quite when they resumed, but they're obviously back online now, I guess.
Do you think? I mean, how long were they down?
I don't know exactly. I know it must have been at least a few hours.
Yeah. Well, you'd think the person who'd tripped over the cable or hit the wrong switch might have, you know, put two and two together a little bit sooner, but.
Yeah.
Well, hey, you know, it's always good for a chuckle. Well, Munir, thank you very much again for taking some time out to speak to Risky Business.
It's a pleasure, mate.
Said Dinet Australia's Munir Kataria there. I should mention that I'm not 100% sure that HP goons went through Stephen Shanklin's garbage. They went through some journalist's rubbish, but I'm not sure about his. It is accurate, however, to say he was not amused by the whole thing. He was one of the journalists HP spied on. We'll be back after this.
Checkpoint is the worldwide leader in securing the internet. Our focus is purely on IT security. Pure Security ensures customers' protection through unified, reliable and extensible solutions. Learn more about the technology that secures 128 of Australia's top 200 companies at checkpoint.com.
Well, it seems unlikely that you'd get some critical comments around IPS from an IPS vendor, but that's exactly what Risky Business experienced at the Aussert Computer Security Conference on the Gold Coast 2 weeks ago. I sat down with Steve Manzik, a security researcher for Juniper Networks, to get his thoughts on IPS and its usefulness.
From a defending against attacks perspective, you know, if you look at host-based IPS, they're still very easy to bypass, and they're still not accurate enough. A lot of vendors are rushing to do, you know, their generic type prevention, where they're just going to generically detect a threat and then do things like kill a process or kill a thread. Well, the problem with that is if you're wrong and you kill a thread or you kill a process, you're now crashing legitimate applications, right, by having that that false detect. So that's definitely an issue on the host side. Things like, you know, we've seen an increase in file format type vulnerabilities, especially over the last year. We've seen an increase in like Word or Excel or PowerPoint, you know, type flaws, and it's very surprising that a lot of the host-based products actually really struggle with parsing those file formats and detecting the bad files and things like that. And you even see that to a point on the network-based as well.
Because is that because binary formats used by Word and stuff, you know, they're proprietary. You don't really know what's in them.
Yeah, that is actually probably most of the problem, is that they are, A, they're proprietary formats, and B, they're very complex formats that have, over the years, kind of evolved with multiple developers and different developers, and there's not a lot of documentation, you know, around those formats. So it really is a headache for the research guys to actually reverse those file formats and figure out exactly what's going on.
You know, what about more on the network side of IPS? What are the limitations there? What are the challenges?
One of the bigger challenges that every network vendor has, first of all, is finding that balance between high performance and reliability. So you have some vendors who can claim that they're the fastest IPS there is, right? Which maybe they are, right? But they're also probably the least accurate as well, right? So as networks become larger and faster, the problem of detecting attacks reliably becomes, you know, a bigger problem. And that's really solved by more of just reviewing your architecture and where you're actually placing your IPS sensors and, you know, and things like that. One of the other issues, too, that I think a lot of IPS vendors struggle with is a lot of the newer protocols and, you know, actually decoding those protocols properly and detecting attacks. If you look at evasion techniques, you know, in the old days, it was things like fragmenting packets and, you know, and things like that would, you know, let you evade an IPS, whereas today we're easily able to detect those. But now if you do things like RPC fragmentation, that's, you know, kind of the new way now to, you know, bypass an IPS, and it's proved to be a very difficult problem, you know, for people to solve and actually detect those types of evasions.
Now, of course, you make all of these criticisms, you level all these criticisms against IPS vendors, and you work for one.
Absolutely, and I think that's actually important, that as a IPS vendor, and especially in, you know, in my role as, you know, running the research team, and, you know, we're the guys that write all the protection in, you know, Juniper's IPS. So I think in my role, it's very important that we understand the limitations and where we need to do better, and, you know, and where we need to fix things. You know, we've seen vendors in the past where they just bury their head in the sand, and that never works, obviously, right? That's not going to, you know, increase security or improve the products, and that's, you know, really what it comes down to.
But you wouldn't write off the technology generally. You think IPS is worthwhile.
Oh, absolutely. Because I think what it really does is it, you know, and it's really like any other security technology. What it does is it raises the bar high enough.
If I hear one more person say it raises the bar, I think I'm going to strangle someone.
You're right, though. But as much as that is a cliche, you know, it is true, though. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to, you know.
Can you just tell me one more? Can you tell me it's not a silver bullet?
you're going to... I hate you, Pat. you're going to catch all of the idiot attackers, you know, for lack of a better way to put it. You really are going to attack all of the, you know, attackers and what they're doing. There is no technology out there that's going to attack the guy that knows what he's doing and the guy that's very careful. That's really the bottom line, right, is that you'll always get that guy that's going to be smarter than the technology or smarter than the people writing the technology. You know, it's been an arms race. It always will be an arms race. There's another cliche for you.
That's another one. Speaking, I wonder if we could do a whole interview focusing entirely on cliches. Now, one of your guys, one of your researchers, is a bloke by the name of Barnaby Jack, who has done some very interesting work on Xscale and ARM processors.
Can you explain
to us a little bit about what that research is?
Yeah, so Barnaby's role, actually, he actually doesn't even work on my team, but he works for security engineering. He works on the team that does all of the internal security, so on Juniper products and things like that, but he still does a lot of vulnerability research and things like that, and so that's where he ends up working with me and my team. So what he did is he actually found a method in the architecture of ARM and Xscale that allows a null pointer vulnerability, which, if anyone that's done security research on, you know, say the PC world, typically when you find a null pointer vulnerability, you know, you stop because, you know, great, this thing's not exploitable, you know, it's going to be a crash, you know, we're not getting to the, you know, right spots in memory, things like that. So what Barnaby did is he actually found that because of the way ARM and Xscale architecture works, is you can actually exploit null pointers, and the defense around that is with the initialization vectors and things like that. But the reason that's really interesting is because it really does open up a whole new attack vector. And that attack vector is things like, you know, embedded devices, you know, so your cell phones, even routers. And
that's what Xscale and ARM processes go into.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know,
it's not just like PDAs and cell phones. It also winds up in things like Ethernet controllers and things like, little embedded network devices. Is that right?
Yes, it does. You know, so especially when you look at, you know, your wireless, you know, hubs and routers and things like that, you do find ARM and Xscale in those. ARM and Xscale make up probably 90% of the embedded market when you look at embedded devices. You're even seeing it in things like microwaves and fridges these days too, which is, you know, that's always the joke, right? But it's, there is an attack vector now, right? And they are putting those things on networks.
So how many vulnerable ARM and Xscale devices, I mean, must be out there now that can't really be easily fixed?
That's the issue, especially when you look at PDAs and cell phones, right? You know, like everyone's cell phones, this is either going to be ARM or Xscale. You know what I mean? Like your cell phone's going to be one or the other. And how do you patch these things? You know, I know on North American networks, they actually disable the over-the-air patching functionality.
Why did they do that?
I think it's probably a performance thing because, you know, they're just moving into, you know, they're just moving into their, you know, 3G and Edge and, you know, all those types of things where they're going to have the bandwidth to do it. But, you know, historically they've never had the bandwidth to be able to handle that. So those have been disabled by, you know, by default on the phones. And it's probably also to, you know, keep control over the software as well, right? Because, you know, they still lock their phones and limit, you know, the functionality of cell phones, you know, in North America quite a bit. So if a vulnerability is found in a cell phone, you know, you're absolutely right. How are you going to patch that? You know, you're not, right? You know, people are going to end up having to, you know, go out and buy new cell phones if the vulnerability is, you know, serious enough.
You're listening to Risky Business, sponsored by Cybertrust. I'm Patrick Gray. Don't forget to check out our other podcast, A Series of Tubes, which is about networking, and it updates on Wednesdays at itradio.com.au. We're talking to Juniper Networks Security Research Manager, Steve Manzik. Not only is Steve an expert on all things IPS, but he manages a pretty decent team of bug hunters. These guys found the first remote root vulnerability in Apple's OS X operating system a few weeks ago. So I asked Steve about the process his colleague Michael Lin went through in finding the vulnerability and what it means for Apple.
He discovered a vulnerability in Mac OS X is remotely exploitable and does give you root privileges. It's something that's running as root, so you will get root on the machine. The thing that makes this vulnerability a little bit less of a risk, just a regular remote root, is that it runs over UDP. Meaning that you're probably not going to find too many people over the internet, to exploit. But things like local area networks and stuff like that, UDP is going to be passed through without any issues. So.
But it does show that OS X isn't the solid bastion Fort Knox of operating systems that Apple make it out to be, is it?
Oh, absolutely, right. And I think most of that is, and we've seen that before with other vendors like Oracle and stuff like that, right, where it's more PR and marketing campaign than actual security, right? And where this vulnerability was found, too, initially was at CanSec West. They had that Hack a Mac contest, and it literally took... Mike, with a group effort with, a few more of our guys, it literally took about 4 or 5 hours to identify the vulnerability. And then we spent some time, writing the exploit code and things like that.
But you didn't hack the Mac?
We did not. No, we did not.
You decided it was too valuable to waste on a laptop and $5,000? Or?
that could have been partially it as well. But it was also actually, legitimately, we actually just ran out of time. We had found the vulnerability. We were writing the exploit code. And by then it was late Friday afternoon at the end of the conference. And they were, disconnecting things. So we essentially ran out of time. And in hindsight, I think that we probably would not have used it, just for that reason as well as, the responsible thing to do is to report it to, Apple and work with them and, get it fixed, not use it to, prove a point at a contest.
Now, I believe you had an, oh my God, I'm a dumbass moment during the research phase of this vulnerability. Can you explain to our listeners what that was?
We did. Because we're not Mac guys, really, initially we had loaded up Data Rescue's IDA and was looking through the compiled piece of the code, for vulnerabilities and things like that. And we actually did identify the vulnerability through that method. But then a few hours later, one of the Mac guys on our team came into the room and said, "You guys realize that this function has been, or this program has been open sourced, or at least pieces of it have. And if you go here, you can get the source code." And so we kind of did the forehead slap thing. But it still proved though that even with that little mistake on our part, in 4 hours, 4 or 5 hours, we still found the vulnerability, and we were correct. We were able to confirm it, with the source code, and go from there with it. So.
Now there were a lot of vulnerabilities discovered in the month of Apple bugs. And I suppose one of the things that I've pointed out to a few people myself is that every month is a month of Microsoft bugs. I mean, do you agree with that statement?
Yeah, I do. Because they're still the big target. Rightfully or wrongfully so, they're still the major target that everyone goes after. And it does really make sense, because if you look at it from an attacker's perspective, you have a larger attack base going after Microsoft-based machines because they have the market share.
Will you be going after... I mean, it's interesting that you actually went after this bug simply for the Hack a Mac contest. I mean, even though you guys are serious full-time researchers, that's what inspired you to do it. Do you think now that it was such an easy score that you're going to keep looking at OS X's code to try to find more stuff?
I would say so. I would say that it's definitely... raise the interest level of a lot of guys on my team.
Simply because it was that easy to find?
Yeah, simply because it was that easy to find. And it is also part of the researcher mentality is, you tell me something secure, we'll try to prove you wrong, right? And so that is, kind of the mentality. And
So maybe the ads with Smarmy Guy, not such a hot idea?
As funny as those ads are, you're right. They're making claims that are just blatantly not true, right? They claim that, there's no such thing as malware for Macs and that they're secure and all that kind of stuff. And it has been proven even before we found this bug, it has been proven that it's not true. If you just look at all the QuickTime bugs and Safari bugs and things like that have been found. One of the guys on my team is Carl Lin, who actually found off the top of my head, I think it's probably 3 or 4 different QuickTime bugs last year and the year before at his previous employer. I'm sure he's definitely going to start stepping it up a little bit now and start looking a little bit more.
Well, we'll be looking forward to seeing developments from your team. Steve Manzik, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Juniper Network's Steve Manzik there. Next up, it's time for our sponsor interview. Each week, we have a CyberTrust staffer on to talk about an issue of the week. This week, it's the massive DDoS attack that crippled Estonia's internet connections. I'm joined now by Paul Nevin, who is a director of CyberTrust Security Operations Center in the Asia-Pacific region. He's also studying a doctorate in information warfare at Charles Sturt University. Now, Paul, it appears that an entire country has been owned.
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but certainly Estonia has come under attack from the internet during late April and early May of this year.
And what were the effects of that attack?
Well, initially it was limited to denial of service against the Prime Minister's website, but quickly escalated to include newspaper sites, TVs, schools, even banks, and literally shutting them down from the internet.
Okay, and it seems there were some sort of cultural or political motivations. It seems to have revolved around the movement of some sort of artifact.
There's a statue in Estonia that commemorates the fall of the Russian soldiers during World War II against the Germans. Now, the Estonians see the statue as symbolism of communist oppression, whereas the Russians, of course, seen as a commemorative statue for their soldiers.
It's a symbol of the victory of the Russians or the Germans?
Sorry, the victory of the Russians over Germany.
Yes, yeah, okay, sure. They're none too happy about that thing being moved.
Oh, that's right, and there's been quite a bit of debate on this topic. The Russians have had protests, they've had embargoes of Estonian products and other forms of protest in the real world, and it appears as though that protest has spilled on the internet.
Well, it would be probably this case is probably the most serious case of politically motivated denial of service attacks that we've ever seen.
It is. It is certainly serious, but it's certainly not the first we've seen. And the Estonian government claimed to be the first victim of a virtual war, but the reality is much, much different. As early back as 1999, I even witnessed a similar attack when Australia sent troops into East Timor. On the day that we announced we were sending troops in, the internet became a very hostile place for Australia. And the attacks were unsophisticated. They were completely uncoordinated, but they were still very effective at shutting down a lot of the infrastructure.
I guess it just didn't matter as much in 1999, though, did it? I mean, we're much more reliant on the internet today.
Well, that's true. Estonia prides itself on being an advanced internet-connected country. It likes to be referred to as e-Estonia, which is quite strange, but it was probably more susceptible to the cyber warfare attack because of its internet adoption.
Now, we're seeing a lot of movements in the sort of cyber warfare realm. We had Richard Clark, who was the former cyber czar and counter-terrorism chief in the United States, on the show a few weeks ago, a couple of months ago now. And, you know, he says that both China and the United States acknowledge that they have a cyber attack capability. And we just saw this report from the US Department of Defense recently, which said some sort of scary things about China's capabilities in that area.
Yeah, that report, the 2007 Department of Defense report to Congress on China's military power, was rather detailed in its explanation of China's cyber warfare or information operation capability. And it had quite a few interesting points in there regarding the way that China saw information operations in the future and how it would incorporate information operations into conventional warfare. The interesting, most interesting point, I think, was that it saw including civilians and its militia in its capability as most important.
I also noticed one thing that might have been a bit of a giveaway in that report is it said that China had previously attacked enemy networks.
Yes, it's pretty well understood that China had developed information warfare capabilities as early as year 2000. There's some metrics that the People's Liberation Army used to determine how they're going in the world. And it was believed that in the year 2000, the metrics, which is known as the Comprehensive National Power, showed that China was underdeveloped in terms of information warfare capabilities and they needed to quickly act. And as early as 2005, they already had developed that capability and they were actively using it in military exercises, largely when pretending to attack Taiwan. It's believed to have quite a capability in terms of defending against their own infrastructure against cyber warfare, as much as creating viruses and attacking critical infrastructure of enemy nations.
So it looks like this stuff that we've sort of, you know, hyped up over the last few years may have actually turned into a real threat.
I think it's been there for some time. It's only becoming more common knowledge now that we see these attacks against entire countries. But cyber espionage has been with us for a very long time. In fact, longer than the World Wide Web as we know it has been around.
Some people have even theorized that many of the worms that we saw in the early 2000s may have been released by foreign nation states testing the West's capability to respond to an internet threat like a worm like Code Red or NIMDA or something like that. Do you give those theories any credence?
I think there's some possibility that people were experimenting with those threats, but I think we've seen generally that worms are dropping off as far as the volumes that have been created because they're not being seen as an effective threat. So nation states may be looking at other avenues, whether it be spear phishing attacks, other forms of exploits to achieve the same ends.
Now, is this about crippling civilian infrastructure or is it about targeting military infrastructure?
Well, on full-on cyber warfare, I think it's fair to say that a lot of nations will generally block access externally, so they won't have the ability, an attacker will not have the ability to shut down critical infrastructure once the country's been shut off. I mean, this is what happened to Estonia. We've also seen the US do it in the past, where they literally firewall their entire country.
But wouldn't that mean that we've already sort of lost in that we're, you know, I mean, our economy would be really, to an extent, crippled if we severed all of our links to the outside world?
It is generally a temporary measure. In this case, in Estonia's case, where we're seeing a form of expression known as hacktivism, it's a political expressionism, it's generally short-lived for a matter of days or weeks at a time when people are simply expressing their anger for whatever reason by breaking in or shutting down systems. Now, that tends to subside after a small amount of time, in which case you can restore connectivity to the rest of the world.
Now, it looks also in the case of this Estonia hack or Estonia DDoS that it wasn't the case of one big master DDoS guy controlling an army of botnets. It looks like it was several attacks from various parties, which is interesting, isn't it? It really indicates that there is a climate in Russia which people are quite angry with Estonia and they're taking matters into their own hands.
That's right. If you're a hacker and you have a political edge, you can go out and express yourself through a DDoS or any other number of attacks.
I prefer writing a letter to the editor of my local newspaper personally, but I guess this is the new world that we're living in, isn't it?
That's correct.
Okay, Paul Nevin, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's it for another edition of Risky Business. We'll be back next week with more news and analysis. Thanks for listening.